Thank you. I will now call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. It's case number A241220, Michonne Ahmad versus Nancy J. Christensen. As counsel likely know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Our protocol on the online video format is substantially similar to our protocol in the courtroom. You should see a time clock on your screen if you have the gallery view or a similar setting on your screen. So, counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Thank you, everybody. Please record again. Patrick Downs. I represent Mr. Ahmad, the appellant. Today, our appeal concerns spousal maintenance award issued. We have three primary concerns. One, that the court did not properly calculate my client's income. The court also improperly discredited or discounted expenses that should have been properly included. And then ultimately, those two errors then led the court to issue an order that awarded spousal maintenance to Ms. Christensen. One of the primary arguments we have concerns the court's, what I would consider the disregard of the factual record that was laid. Both parties submitted and stipulated to a number of exhibits, including tax returns, documents concerning my client's business operations, and extensive amounts of bank records, which included personal records and business records from my client. One of the primary concerns, again, is this: the court, in a number of instances in the order, makes statements or claims that it had insufficient information and insufficient documentation, which we don't believe comports with the actual record. The record was rather complete. The record was rather clear. There was a full day of testimony. There's also a number of instances where I think the court is cherry picking information. One of the.
Mr. Downs, can I interrupt it and to address this point? It seems to me that, I mean, the situation is that the parties were in trial in September of 2023, and your client is attempting, was attempting, and is now attempting to emphasize evidence concerning his business's income in that year. And the trial occurred in mid-year. It's easy, of course, to look at prior years when there's tax returns and so on, but the evidence is inevitably a little bit different about the current year. I think you probably would agree with that generally. But go ahead. I mean, if you want to make a comment about my comment,
and I kind of go into this at length, which is the court and makes a real heavy emphasis on the order issued in April of 23, which was findings based upon a motion that was heard in January based on evidence that was presented at the end of 22. The court basically gives itself permission in the final order that says, well, I think it's paragraph 36 of the court's order. Okay. The court basically, it's for me, this was a real kind of linchpin of the case, which is, it declines to take a look at the information given for 2023, and it says, it gives a couple of reasons. Some of them is a lack of transparency on business expenses, why they were so high. The court, in its order, cherry picks the expenses it gives in 2022 and compares them to 21, which happened to be a low year. We gave expenses and taxes that show back for 5 years. So the actual expenses in 2022 were in line with and actually on average equal to or less than most of the expenses for the year. So the court picks 2 years to compare and says they're out of line instead of picking the 5 years that we gave and saying, well, they're actually in line. So the court at multiple times cherry picks information, not because there's a lack of information, but because it gets her to the result that she wants, which is, I'm only going to compare.
Not necessarily the result that she wants. I mean, we have a judge that has said that your client was not credible. And that is the basis that you call it cherry picking, but this is the power of a trial court, their discretion. I just, how do you get around that? How do we address that when we have that in our record?
It's not a matter of credibility. There was no line of questioning. There was no evidence that ever called into question my client's desire to work, ability to work, or his truthfulness or credibility. This was a manufactured issue for the court. There's again, the transcript, there's no line of question, there's no piece of evidence that directly says that my client is somehow misinforming the court. The court, again, paragraph 36, the court says, and there's a couple of times where the court says, Mr. One of the credibility issues was he failed to provide business records for M&N.
Let me interrupt, Mr. Downs, because I need to push back on this issue. My understanding of the record is that there what other than your client's testimony, and there's a question. Your client testified that he did not withhold his income, but was there any independent evidence that there was market volatility, that this wasn't the COVID time of year? Was there any other independent informational source besides your client saying, my income went down?
Well, we have the tax returns. We have we exhibits two. We exhibit we sent in 4 years of closings where it showed the closings went down over the course of the time period of question. They went down 65%. So again, it wasn't a matter of credibility. We have evidence that showed closings were down, sales were down. My client has been in the business for 18 years. He reasonably understands how the market works. He testified credibly as to what is going on. And again, the court is saying one of the reasons why I'm having problems with credibility is he didn't submit a business form. There is no business form. These are LLCs. They're pass-through tax entities. The court also makes a reference in there that I can't remember paragraph that there's a problem. He said, well, I'm not sure like what these taxes are. Are these business taxes or are they personal taxes? Therefore, I'm not going to count these towards the client's expenses. So there's a number of times where I think the court makes statements that call into question whether or not the court really understood what's an LLC, how does it work, what's a pass-through tax entity, because she's asking for records that don't exist, and she's saying, because I didn't get the records that don't exist, I don't have the information necessary. Every
You
single one
had
of them.
Mr. Downs, a stipulated expert report, and it showed that the real estate expenses they jumped up about 50% of its revenue. What was the explanation that was given to the court on why that revenue that was reported by the stipulated expert jumped up so much? There has to be a basis submitted to the court so that there's logic in a decision that's being made. What was presented?
What was presented were the tax forms, including the Schedule Cs. Again, this goes to my question, which is the
I'm
court
talking
keep.
about the expenses. What expenses? What was the reason that the expenses leapfrogged like that?
Agent commissions. If you look at page two of my submission, we break it down into a table. We break it down by percentage. So the largest variable year to year is agent commissions, which is on Schedule C, which is listed. And again, there was testimony. There's no question that there's testimony. My client has agents. They're 1099. All of their commissions and all of the costs are on Schedule C, broken down category by category. They are separated out. They're in there. There is
But okay, so Mr. Downs, but then that begs the question. I mean, if you're comparing 2022 to 2021, I mean, revenue went down significantly, I would say by about a third, roughly, from 354 to 270,000. That's the information in front of me from the stipulated expert report. But agent commissions went up, tripled from the prior year. I mean, so why would agent commissions go up so much when revenue is going down? I mean, and is there evidence in the record that explains that?
again, the tax forms, okay, for every $1,000 of agent sale, my client was getting 20% of it, right? So,
I understand that, but the
correct.
question is, what happened? How can those two things coexist in 2022? I mean, I understand the tax tax returns are in evidence, and they give the numbers. But I guess I think what the district court was thirsty for and didn't get from your client is why exactly that number, agent commissions, went up so dramatically in 2022, a year in which revenue went down significantly. Is there any evidence in the record that explains that?
Other than the testimony and just the
well,
the
what
banker.
Is the testimony? I've looked for that. I don't see any explanation for why that number went up so dramatically. I think your argument is it did, but if you want to add credibility to that statement or to the tax returns, it could have your client could have put in some more evidence explaining why that number went up so much.
Well, I guess the agent commissions are what they are. They're reflected in the bank records. They show that they were actual expenditures out. We've gave the bank records for the M&N, so you can see what's coming in. You can see what's going out.
Okay, but do you acknowledge the reason why a neutral fact finder might be curious or concerned, or perhaps the fact that revenue went down significantly but agent commissions tripled? But those two things are inconsistent with each other, I think.
Well, are we talking about the actual commission? Or are we talking about the overall expense? Because
I'm talking about the expense of $75,000 in commission expense in 2022, which is three times the prior year, and then in the years before that, 2018, 2019, and 2020, the amount is zero. And I don't quite understand that either, because I believe the testimony is that he's worked with agents for 7 years.
Right.
So,
again, that's
so, so why would he have zero in the prior years?
He doesn't. The tax reform, the tax returns show that there are agent commissions. That's why I put the table on page two of my brief. So you can go through and see that Schedule C is showing that there are commissions being paid year after year after year. Now, 57% was a little high, but back in 2018, agent commissions were 52%. So again, there is a record that shows year after year within the taxes on the Schedule Cs, you're seeing that there is the agent, I'm trying to recall.
Okay, can I, and now Mr. Downs, now I'm noticing, looking at your table on page two of your brief. Your table includes amounts for the years 2018, 2019, and 2020 that differ from the expert report of Mr. Burning. Mr. Burning shows zeros there. You show 54,000, 41,000, 51,000.
Well, I didn't rely on the expert report. I went to the actual source data, which was a tax returns. Mr. Burning wasn't called. He was involved with this case with the prior attorney. I had no real dealings with him. So I went to the actual tax forms and looked at the Schedule Cs and pulled the numbers that we provided to the court so that we're not working off some other person's interpretation or misinterpretation of the facts. I'm looking at the actual source documents.
Okay, well, I guess the question remains, in my mind, the question remains about 2022, and I think this was the question in the district judge's mind too. I think based on the document I'm looking at, Mr. Burning's report, other expenses in 2022 were largely in line with 2021. The one thing that sticks out like a sore thumb, so to speak, is commission expense. That's dramatically larger than the prior year, and I think that factored into the district court's reasoning, correct?
It did, but the problem being is that we were in 2023. The court had actual 2023 data. The court chose to rely on the order it made for its reasonableness standard based on information that was given in 2022. My argument is that the court should have used the actual data presented at trial, used the testimony given, and not relied upon either an estimate that was given well before the trial or rely on an order that actually set the 2023 and 2022 income based on incomplete 2022 and zero 2023. The court had volumes of information it could have used. to determine income, to take a look at what the income was. It chose not to because it said there was a document that doesn't exist that it didn't get, that it didn't have the information when it had all the tax returns and all the bank statements that corresponded to it.
But did it? So, but there were no tax records for 23. You're right, right? There couldn't be.
Not for 23, but there was ample testimony concerning the number of closings, the amounts made, and we had all the bank records essentially up to the point where we had to submit our documentation. So yes, the trial was in September. Obviously submissions had to be in prior to that, but the court still had 7 or 8 months of actual data it could have used as opposed to the made up number it had from April of 2023 in its order, which was based on 2022 data, which that in itself was also incomplete.
Can you remind me what finding, what net income, net business income for your client did you urge the court to find? Like, can you remind me? And is that like looking at page two of your brief, I see that for 22, you would say the net business income that year was 136,000. But what amount did you ask the district court to find for his income as of the time of trial?
We basically used the bank records. I can't give you that number off the top of my head. And I know my time has expired, so I'm
maybe during rebuttal you could and then my follow up question or the corollary question is, given your preferred finding of his income, would he still have a surplus, a monthly surplus, and you know, and would the overall result have been any different? Would the district court still have found, or could the district court have found in that circumstance that he still has the ability to pay spousal maintenance? We can talk about that on rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bethany Hurd, and I represent respondent Nancy Christensen in this matter. Mr. Ahmad is dissatisfied with how the district court weighed the evidence presented at trial. His dissatisfaction does not prove that the district court's decision was clearly erroneous or against logic in the facts on the record. The court found that Ms. Christensen had proven a need for spousal maintenance that is not on appeal today, and that Mr. Ahmad had the ability to pay her $2,800 per month indefinitely. Obviously, that is at issue today. The main issues on appeal are are the court's calculation of Mr. Ahmad's income and his expenses, which go directly to his ability to pay spousal maintenance. First, looking at appellant's income, the court can use an obligor's or look at an obligor's earning history and earning capacity to determine, in this case, Mr. Ahmad's income for purposes of spousal maintenance in two scenarios. First, if the court finds that the obligor acted in bad faith or unjustifiably self-limited his income. And secondly, if it is impracticable to determine the obligor's actual income. Turning first to the unjustifiably self-limiting income. Sources for this include the cases of Melius versus Melius and Warwick v. Warwick.
Ms. Hurd, can I stop you here? Did the district court make a finding of bad faith?
It did not explicitly make a finding of bad faith. It did, as I think the court has noted here, express concern, and I think that is the exact language that the court used in multiple findings. It expressed concern that Mr. Ahmad was not providing a full picture of his income for the purposes of avoiding spousal maintenance or limiting his ability to pay spousal maintenance. There are many detailed findings about the court's concerns and the basis of those, including things that have been already discussed, such as commissions from the agent sales, the confusion surrounding that. I would point out
And I was going to ask as a follow-up question whether, and I do recall the district court using the word concerned, and I'm wondering whether, in your view, that constitutes a finding of what the concerns are.
That's a good question. There is not an express finding of bad faith. That is certain. I think what the court more so relies on is that it is impracticable to find Mr. Ahmad's current income. So I think essentially reading the court's findings, I believe that that is more so what the ultimate conclusion of the court was, is that it could not determine his current income. My understanding at trial was that Mr. Ahmad was relying on his 2023 figures, which included a report of his income from January to May of 2023 and a projection of what, based on those numbers, and that was his slow season. Additionally, there was testimony under cross-examination of additional sales that Mr. Ahmad, or I'm sorry, of additional closings Mr. Ahmad had completed in 2023 since May of 2023 to the time of trial in September of 2023. And so I believe he is relying on those numbers for the court to look at his income. However, as a self-employed realtor, it's very well known that income varies month to month, year to year. And in these cases, courts often look at averages over years to determine income for spousal maintenance purposes. It would be just as unfair to look at Mr. Ahmad's highest grossing year to determine his income as his lowest grossing year. Therefore, an average is typically appropriate in these cases. In this case, Ms. Christensen supplied an expert report, which the court has referenced, with a five-year average spanning 2018 to 2022. So the first five complete years of sales and income and expense records that can be provided. As the court's already noted, this expert report by Mr. Burning was stipulated to. Any right to cross-examination was waived. Mr. Burning did not appear as a witness in the trial. And so the court is not misplaced, you know, its discretion is not misplaced in looking at or relying on this report. It could certainly reference the other exhibits provided, which included tax returns. However, the court is not also in a position to be a forensic accountant, right? It is the parties and counsel's job to walk the court through what findings they believe the court should make.
Ms. Hurd, could you explain for me the discrepancy between Mr. Burning's accounting of commission expenses in the earlier years, 2018, 2019, and 2020, as compared to appellant's brief page 2, which shows five-figure numbers, which Mr. Downs says come from the tax returns? Why did Mr. Burning not rely upon the tax returns for that type of expense in those years?
Your Honor, this question is just new to me now in this hearing, but if I'm looking at, for the court's reference, Trial Exhibit 101, which is the report of Mr. Burning that has been referenced, specifically page 4 of that report. So this is the summary where it spells out kind of those business expenses. I believe the discrepancy the court's referring to is in categorization of these commissions. So line 4 says commissions. It does not have, it has zeros, as the court referenced, for 2018, 19, and 20. And then 2021 and 2022, it has 24,000 roughly and 75,000 respectively. I believe that line 24, it's categorized as outside services. So 54,000 roughly, 41,000 and 51,000. I believe that has to do, I have not verified this, but I believe that has to do with how the commissions were categorized on the schedule in the tax returns. And that may have been.
That does match page 2 of appellant's brief. So, but perhaps I think you've answered my question. Thank you very much. Uh, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I know you were, but you may proceed with what you were saying before I interrupted.
Thank you. So as the court has pointed out, Mr. Burning has calculated Mr. Ahmad's average profit from his realty business, including revenue less business expenses, to approximately $190,115. That is adding back a nominal amount of depreciation. That is highlighted on page 4 of Exhibit 101. So again, that is what Mr. Burning found his average profit from the business was over those 5 years. Mr. Ahmad importantly affirmed the accuracy of these numbers under cross-examination for each of the years. You'll find that in the transcript. After calculating the income taxes Mr. Ahmad would owe on that profit, Mr. Burning concluded that Mr. Ahmad's net after-tax income would be approximately $11,264 per month. And that is apparent later in his report on page 12, where it calculates his income taxes based on that $190,000. The court, as has been mentioned, the court declined to adopt Mr. Ahmad's 2023 numbers to determine his income for spousal maintenance purposes. Instead, it found that Mr. Ahmad's income was not inconsistent with its prior determination for temporary support purposes. It went so far as to make additional findings that even if Mr. Ahmad's net after-tax income was $10,833 per month at the lowest, he would still have a surplus sufficient to pay spousal maintenance. So even if the court could not accurately determine what his current income is or was, it did not abuse its discretion in looking at the evidence presented and making a determination that he did, in fact, have the ability to pay spousal maintenance. I'd like to turn briefly to Mr. Ahmad's expenses and the arguments associated with that. As the court knows, the district court can adjust claimed reasonable expenses, and those adjustments are subject to the abuse of discretion standard of review. We look to Arendelle for that. There are four main categories of budget expenses that the court adjusted for Mr. Ahmad, namely his claimed credit card expense of $400 per month, his claimed IRS debt servicing of $1,000 per month, his medical insurance premium, which was reduced, and his out-of-pocket medical and dental insurance expenses of $270 per month. With respect to the credit cards, there is evidence in the record from testimony and credit card statements, as well as Mr. Ahmad's claimed budget, that there is a significant overlap between the items that Mr. Ahmad used his credit card for, or I'm sorry, the purchases he used his credit cards for, and other line items on his budget, namely utilities, car washes, clothing, things like that. Additionally,
Ms. Hurd, is it clear? Is the evidence clear about whether are we talking about regular recurring credit card charges, or are we talking about an outstanding balance, an outstanding debt that is being paid down on a consistent basis?
The record is not clear on that. It is on Mr. Ahmad's budget. It is included under a category called debt servicing. In which case, the alternative argument would be that that was a pre-existing debt that he is servicing and not for recurring expenses. If that's the case, it's a similar argument to the tax repayment plan in that any debt that existed on those credit cards was part of the party's stipulated property settlement, which was adopted by the court and, in fact, included in as an exhibit in the trial record.
Was that also, I'm trying to catch up with all these expenses. Was that also the IRS debt that it was a part of the, was that a part of the property settlement?
It was. And
it
so
was, part, so it was calculated as part of how they were dividing things up. So not a genuine expense. An expense as far as property, but not a, it would be double dipping for it to be a secondary expense.
That is correct. So part of the party's part of the party's property settlement was their 2021 and part of 2022 income tax liabilities. Mr. Ahmad had entered into a payment plan with the IRS in the amount of $1,000 per month on those years of tax returns or tax liabilities. And so it is an ongoing expense that Mr. Ahmad incurs. It is a valid debt. Perhaps that's misconstrued, but it is a valid debt that he is paying on. No one has disputed that. However, it was part of the bargain for property settlement, and to include it or essentially increase Mr. Ahmad's budget or reduce his ability to pay spousal maintenance for that would be double counting, or in divorce math, right, giving him the benefit of the debt twice as it relates to Ms. Christensen. There is support for not including these expenses or reducing a claimed budget for these things from a property settlement found in the cases of Fulmer v. Fulmer, and a particularly on-point non-precedential case of this court from 2018, Duesenberg v. Duesenberg, which did not allow that sort of double counting expense. Additionally,
can I stop you there? I feel like that double counting case law often refers to assets and whether the income from the assets may be counted, but I'm not sure. Is there case law specifically about debts?
Yes, those two cases are specifically about debts and property settlement.
Thank you.
I won't spend too much time on the medical premium. Mr. Ahmad entered his own exhibit number 13, I believe, which verifies that his medical insurance premium is $725 per month. There's no support for the claimed $917 per month. And additionally, there is no support in the record or evidence that Mr. Ahmad had any significant medical or dental issues that would substantiate a claim of $270 per month in out-of-pocket expenses. If there are no further questions from the court, I will conclude my argument there.
It appears there are none. Thank you, Ms. Hurd. Mr. Downs, as we said earlier, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument.
I believe my client estimated his income at $70,000 as of the time of trial. This is not a Fulmer case. Fulmer is not on point here. This is a tax liability. It is not a debt. In Fulmer, it was a 2-1. It wasn't even a unanimous decision, and there's a vigorous dissent. This is a liability. My client's self-employed, so he doesn't. He gets the money, but he figures out his taxes. So this is not a debt. He's not using this to manipulate or to adjust the property settlement on the back end. This is actually a tax liability is a reduction to income. It's not a debt. But because he's self-employed, it kind of carries over like a debt because you don't know what it is until you look at it, you've calculated the previous year. Fulmer is not on point. This is not that case. Take a look at the facts. This is a tax liability. And it is a valid liability that Mr. Ahmad must pay, and it should have been calculated as a part of estimating how much income he has available. No one is saying you can't pay your taxes. No one say you shouldn't pay your taxes. If he was a payroll employee, it would just come out. He'd never see it, but he's self-employed. So he's got to account for it. The court must account for it. And again, the court makes this weird comment about, well, I don't know if it's a business debt or if it's a tax debt. I don't know what it is, so I'm just going to throw it out. That's an abuse of discretion. And this is not a former case. This is not on point. Also, as to expenses, the court abuses its discretion by essentially engaging what's an opposite analysis when it talks about the donations and the travel. There's ample testimony that throughout the course of their marriage, they were generous people. They gave to charitably, and my client traveled to Iraq almost every single year except for COVID. The court makes a statement that my client is asking for these budgetary items. He's asking to continue to give contributions, that he's asking to continue to travel for the purposes of increasing his expenses and not paying. That's the opposite of what the analysis is supposed to be. The analysis is, what was the pattern during the marriage? What did the clients prioritize? Even after they were separated, and even if they were filing their own separate taxes, they were both making charitable contributions. So the court abuses its discretion when it reduces those things and it takes those things away from my client's budget. And it also, again, as to the tax issue, it This is not double counting. This is not a Fulmer case. This is not a debt. It's a tax liability that must be accounted for somehow. And again, we're kind of in a weird spot because he's self-employed. So he's not paying it every 2 weeks like a normal, like a person would during their payroll. We're constantly playing catch up, but it has to be there. And it's not double counting. It's not double dipping. The court is incorrect when it made that finding in its order. And again, I really want to go back to, again, the court makes a number of comments about taxes and about information and documentation. And again, the paragraphs, 36 and 37 of the court's order really kind of go into it. And again, I don't think the court fundamentally understood the nature of the passer entity. I don't think the court fundamentally understood what information was being given on Schedule C, which we talked about. We talked about 1099s. All of this was presented to the courts. The idea that we're going to walk through every single exhibit line by line, every single 40-page tax return line by line as a part of the presentation, that's not the way trials happen. We submit documents, we speak to them, we lay foundation. And again, these documents were all these tax returns, all these expenses, all of these things, the income, these were all relied upon in mediation. These all, when we put in the stipulated agreement on the property, I mean, this became the law of the case. So to kind of backwards now to go back, and say, oh, well, we don't think 2022 or 2021, we've got some real questions about this. Well, there weren't any questions in mediation. There weren't
Mr.
any
Downs,
questions.
I'm sorry, I want to, before time expires, I'd like to ask one or two more questions. So the $75,000 of agent commissions expense in 2022, I think you've earlier stated that's on his tax return Schedule C. Is there any evidence in the record that provides the detail for those expenses? In other words, the individual amounts that were paid to particular agents?
I don't recall if we submitted his 2018 business.
2022, I'm talking about now.
In 2022. The 2022 Wells Fargo statements would show all of the agent commissions and checks written out. So again, they're there. So now they don't identify the particular agent. He had, again, the testimony has three agents, but it shows that checks were paid out to the agents, that the commissions were actually paid.
One more question. You said at the outset of your rebuttal that his position at trial was that his income was only $70,000 per year.
Up to the point of September, through the nine closings, I think the estimate was about $70,000. And again, there were some closings that happened post-trial submissions, but trial, matter of fact, I think there was even a closing the day before of trial. So the testimony brought that out and kind of brought us up to speed as of the day of trial.
So $70,000 year to date as of the date of trial, is that what you're saying?
Right.
And my question, I guess, is whether there's a document that sort of pulls together all the calculations, or is it solely his oral testimony about that fact?
It would have been based on testimony.
Okay. Thank you. If no other judge has any further questions, then the case will be submitted. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you.